Okay, good afternoon. So today we're going to move on from our introduction into sort of the basic structure of a processor and our layers of abstraction and talk a bit about C in particular. But first we're going to talk about sort of how C gets translated into machine code and a bit more about that process that you learned about in 2150, but maybe kind of in a very hand-wavy way. It will probably still be pretty hand-wavy, but maybe not as much. But first, some logistic notes. So ordinarily, we will have a post-quiz after every week of lecture released on Thursday night. So the time I wrote down typically is 7, maybe I'll move that earlier, but I basically want time after this lecture if I don't cover what I think I cover to fix the quiz. So you actually know what's on it, and due by the end of the day Saturday. And a pre-quiz, which there won't be one of next week because I messed up the textbook order apparently. I thought I made a textbook order, and apparently I didn't. The bookstore should know now. Might take them a week or two. Maybe you'll get textbooks from elsewhere. We'll still use a textbook in this course. It's not so necessary for the first few weeks anyways, but ordinarily we'd like you to do some reading beforehand. So you come to lecture kind of knowing what's going on, which should make it a lot easier to learn things in lecture if you kind of know what's going on and don't come in completely clueless most of the time. So let me show you what the quiz looks like. So this is our web app for the quiz. So after you take a quiz, immediately on the closing date, we release the answer. So you can go back and see what the correct answers were. The percentages are how many people answered each answer. I'm the only one who took this demo, so they're very boring. And this is released immediately at the closing time of the quiz, which means we can't let you take quizzes late. But it also means that if you're curious about some question, you can look up the answer right away, and I'll be glad to answer questions about it the following day in lecture. And when you actually take the quiz, and, it will look something like this. We'll ask you for confirmation. So you notice that there's an opening and closing time and a time limit. When you start the quiz, that's when your time starts ticking down. So please don't start the quiz, close your browser window, eat dinner, and come back because you'll be out of time. I've had people do this, please don't do it. This is why there's this confirmation dialogue, which I think has probably kept this from happening again. And when you take it, you'll have multiple choice and questions like this. When you select an answer and the box turns green, your answer is recorded, there's no submit button. If it doesn't turn green, something's wrong, email us, we'll try to figure out what's going on. So immediately when you submit answers, they're done, they're there. You can exit the quiz window. If you come back, your answers before the time limit, your answers will still be there and you can correct them. Any questions on this? Yes. Yes, before your time limit, yeah. So if your Wi-Fi goes down, you still can finish it up, assuming it comes back up and things like that. So any questions about this? Okay, so that starts tonight for this week of lectures. We probably just won't have pre-quizzes for the first couple, 2 weeks to let people have time to get a textbook. I don't know when and if the bookstore will have them. I just asked this afternoon, they haven't gotten back to me, but I'm sure you also have other ways of getting textbooks. So that's that. And I note that there's a comment form on each of these. We will have TAs actually read the comments and adjust your grade accordingly. It won't happen immediately, so it won't be in the auto grade thing, but someone will go through afterwards and look at the comments. When writing comments, I note that the question order is randomized for everyone, so we just randomize all the options, which means that please do not refer to the first choice or A in your comment, because that's different for everyone. We won't know what you're referring to. You could probably figure it out, but it's very tedious for us. Okay. And, well, there's no, so there's no, no, that's not the right one. There's no pre-quiz, so that's not in here. But note on next week's sort of reading, we're going to use x86 assembly, and we'll be, throughout this course, using AT&T syntax assembly, which is not what you used in 2150. Used Intel syntax in 2150. There's some important differences. The textbook has a brief description at the end of section 3.3. I don't think that description is really great for figuring it out. We'll go over it in more detail in lecture. But you should be aware of that. That's what you should expect to see in the textbook if you have it. And all throughout this course, that's what we'll be using. So it's the other syntax of assembly, including today. So also lab accounts. So they should work now. There's a typo in the body of the email of spring for fall. You can ignore that as long as the subject line is right. If you registered this week, earlier this week, like Wednesday or earlier, probably you'll get your account today once the IT people process it. I'll try to look for more people who registered late and tell them about it. If you don't have an account by next Monday, email me and I will do something about it. Okay. Also, slides and video and audio are up on the website on the schedule page, so click the schedule link at the top, and I will post slides plus audio for every lecture below there. And in the morning, or the 12 p.m. lecture, I messed up the video recording, didn't do it for this one, but I'll have whatever I have available. And also, there's anonymous feedback on Colab, and I do read it. And as a final piece of logistics, so TA office hours should start next week. I have office hours, they're listed there, that will be posted on the website. I'm not sure what my Friday office hours will actually end up being. It depends on how I schedule some things. Yes? Yes, we have it. So the question is, do we have a Thursday quiz today? Yes. There's just no pre-week quizzes until for the probably next week and probably the week afterwards. And if you go to the quiz page, I have made it very clear if there's a missing quiz. I put a quiz there which just says where the title is no pre-quiz for this week. So you know that it's not posted, it's that really there's no. And I will try to do that consistently. We also like skip quizzes on exam weeks and things like that for obvious reasons. So any questions about logistics? Any logistical matters? Yeah?
Okay, is text access online or not?
I am not aware of an online copy, but one might exist. If you can find one, that's fine. I would note that we don't care about like page numbers or exercises. So as long as you have a third edition, it probably doesn't matter if it's some 4-in-1 or something. But I haven't seen any of the other editions, so I don't know. We're just looking at using it for readings. Any other logistics questions? Yeah. Yes, so the quizzes at the end of each week, the question is what's on the quiz? Quizzes at the end of each week will be on things we covered in lecture that week. So you're absolutely allowed to refer to the textbook, but you should be able to answer all the questions on the basis of what was covered in lecture or lab. Okay, so last time we looked at processors and memory. We built up, what a processor kind of is. It's this logic that communicates with storage and things outside the processor, most notably memory, where our program's data is and machine code is versus the processor where its computation happens. And we talked about memory as this array of bytes. So that's our view of memory for this course. It's not how memory physically works, but this is our abstraction. So that's an array of bytes. Each byte has a number associated with it. We can draw it in various orders. And we also talked about endianness, where sometimes we have to interpret multiple elements from this array as a bigger value. This was something we're going to do all the time, because we don't usually work with one byte integers in computers. We usually work with bigger ones, but our memory supports accessing each byte individually, so we need to decide on what bytes we get out. And we have these two ways that real hardware does use, both little endian and big endian, which is depending on what we decide the byte with the lowest number ends up being in the integer we're interpreting, whether it's the least significant or most significant part of that. And in this course, as I said, we'll always be using little endian, but the real world uses a variety. So any questions on these topics from last time? So this is our abstraction of memory, this list of bytes. And there's a particular convention for how this is going to be used by programs. So this is the layout of memory, what parts of memory have what kind of information that is used by convention on 64-bit Linux. So we have our stack, which is where we store information that comes from local variables and functions, and also possibly information being passed to functions or saved temporarily from functions. We have our heap, which is where we have things like new and malloc data. And we also have our global variables and our actual machine code. So the stack and the heap, this is stuff that either comes from calling functions or from calling malloc or new. And that's going to be determined when we run the program. We have to run part of the program to figure out what that is. Then we have things like globals and the machine code, which are fixed when we build our executable, what their initial values are. So that's basically going to be copied from disk into a particular part of memory. In Linux, they've chosen to copy it starting at this address. That's an arbitrary choice. You could do something else, and many systems do something else. Possibly even Linux does something else sometimes. But this is basically what's in an executable, is that machine code and the initial values of all those global variables. That's literally the contents of the executable that are actually used. There's some other information, but the important information is just copied directly from the executable to memory. You also notice that we have these holes here. So later in the semester, we'll talk about how can we have these huge regions of memory that we aren't using. We'll talk about how that actually works in hardware. It's not as wasteful as it seems. And it's related to things like segfaults. So any questions about this overall layout and these various parts of memory? Yeah?
Can you just go over what the stack is one more time?
So the question is, what is the stack? So the stack is where functions store data that needs to live for the lifetime of the function. So one example is that when we run out of places to put arguments in registers, we put them on the stack, because that's information the function needs for its function call, but no time later. When we have local variables in a function, and we can't store them in registers, we store them on the stack, because that's a place where we can store something that will be around for as long as the function is, but not longer. If we wanted something to be around for longer than the function, we can't put it on the stack, because when we return from a function, we've told future functions, hey, all that space I was using on the stack, it's yours now. So we have to use something like the heap for that. Is that any follow-up questions? Or other questions about anything on this picture? Okay. So this is our layout, and let's talk a little about how we get the executable data in this format. So in 2150, you've learned sort of the steps, but probably not too much detail about what you do. So you know that we go from C code to assembly to an object file. So last lecture, everyone heard of object files, so you apparently probably have heard of those, I guess. So you go to something called an object file, which I don't think you really learn what's in one, so we'll talk a little about what's there. And somehow we take the object file, one or more object files, and turn that into an actual executable, which is what contains this data to copy directly into memory. And we have, these steps are followed every time we build something in C. So we have individual commands which do each step alone. And you probably usually didn't use those. Probably usually you did something like this, where you produced it directly. You skip the steps. And it might seem like that there's a shortcut where we just take where the compiler reads the C file and directly produces an executable. But internally, what's happening is the compiler is still producing the assembly and still producing an object file and still doing all the same steps. You just don't see the files. They're stored somewhere where you can't get them. So always all those steps are happening. So let's look at what happens at each step. So let's start with our nice simple example program, which is my hello world program where I'm calling puts. This is a function that is in the C standard library to output a string to the terminal with absolutely no other features. So the first thing the compiler is going to do is translate this to an assembly file. So this is what that assembly file might look like. So you'll notice that we have both the actual assembly code, but we also needed to put in that assembly file our actual data that's referenced. We had to go somewhere because we aren't giving the thing which produces the object file anywhere else to get that string. So it better be in the assembly file. And in this assembly file, I've marked one part as text and another part as data. And this says the text part is what I want to be placed in the part of memory used for code, and the data part is where I want to be placed in the part of memory where we expect global variables to be. This is my indicators to the assembler, which the assembler is going to use when it produces the object file. So let's think, what do we need to have in the object file? So this is our assembly file. What are we going to put in the object file based on this? Can give me something that needs to be in that the object file when we produce it. Some of the answers should be easy. Yeah?
I'm guessing the string logo is going to be enough.
Yeah, so we probably need to have this string here, so it better be in the object file in some form. Because it ultimately needs to make it into the executable, needs to be placed in the memory for string constants or global variables, so it better be in the object file. Anything else that the assembler better put in the object file? Someone else have an idea? Yeah.
How would they call it puts?
Okay, so the call to puts. What format is that going to be? How is that going to be in the object file?
The rest of the code.
Yeah, I guess I'm not. Maybe didn't ask the right question. So we need to have the call in there somehow. So, one thing we're not just going to copy the assembly directly into the object file. That's not a useful thing for the assembler to do. So what do we expect the assembler to do to the assembly code? Okay, so you think it might pull outputs. So this would be a perfectly reasonable thing to do. So that we might say the assembler, you're responsible not only for reading this assembly code, but also for looking at all the names it uses and figuring out where those are implemented. That would be a reasonable choice. This is not what we've chosen to do on these systems, though. That's going to be done later on in the linking step. So somehow, the assembler is still doing work, but it's not doing that piece of work, which we absolutely do need to do. And part of the reason is that the step of going from a .s file to a .o file is not going to depend on any other file. So it's not going to depend on the standard library at all. And this allows us to relink with a new standard library without rebuilding all the .o files. But we will do that step later, but just not now. But there is something we need to do to the call before we do that. So is this stuff in the .s file in the format we wanted in the executable? Yeah. Yes, we need machine code. The computer expects machine code, and this is the step where we've chosen to translate to machine code, and that's most of the work the assembler is doing. So one thing we're going to have is we're going to have the text part, and we're going to translate that to machine code. So we're going to figure out, hey, how do you write a sub in machine code? How do you write a move, a call, an XOR in machine code? And we're going to write down the bytes that correspond to that. Yes? The question is, what's the name of the step from the .c to .s? That is called compiling. The step from assembly to object file is called assembly. And as someone mentioned, we also need to have the string in there, so we'll also write down in our .o file, in addition to here's the machine code for that assembly, here's the bytes for that string. I'm showing this in hexadecimal. This is just so it's readable on a slide. You probably wouldn't waste space in a real object file writing things out in hexadecimal. Okay. So is there anything else we need? So there's something I alluded to being missing. Yes? Question? Yeah. So the question is, in that those bytes, you know, what do they correspond to? Is it just the opcodes? Do we have the registers? So it has all the information that the assembler can figure out from this file alone. That it can fill in the machine code. Yes.
So the .s and .o file have the same instructions, but they go to different parts of the machine.
So the question is, do that S and O file have the same instructions, but they're somehow different?
Yeah.
So the difference between the instructions is the biggest difference is format. So in the .s file, they're literally text. This is literally the contents of the .s file. In the .o file, they're the format the processor is going to expect. So that's the main difference. And there's something related to the question earlier of finding puts, which is also missing. So, someone earlier, yeah.
So you said it wasn't dependent on libraries. It assumes you're going to have multiple .o files, and then you're going to link them eventually. So one of them is going to have the dependency for the library, which is
going to make puts. Yeah. So the remark was something else is going to have the dependency for this, and we're going to link them later. Yeah. So we have this call to puts here. And the assembler doesn't know what version of puts you're going to even use. So it can't fill in the call to puts, which means that we somehow generated machine code with a call that doesn't work. So what happens here is the assembler generates machine code. So like for the subtract instruction, it generates the bytes corresponding to that instruction, straightforward. But for something like the move, it knows how to generate part of the move, but it doesn't know how to put in the address of the string that needs to be in that move instruction. So it just puts in a placeholder. In this case, all zeros. So it leaves it blank, but it has the rest of the machine code filled in. So it's done most of the work, but later on in linking, we're going to need to fill in those all zeros with wherever in memory we actually put this string. And we don't know where that is yet, because we don't know what other object files are going to make up our executable. And similarly, we have a placeholder for puts. So in puts, we have this call instruction, but we don't know where the address we're calling is, so we leave it as all zeros, and we'll fill it in later. So to do this, what other stuff should we record in the object file? to help the linker out? What would be a good thing to know? So we've generated this machine code that won't work because it's correct except put s and the actual address of the string aren't there. Because we don't know them yet. So what should we tell the linker? Yeah.
Tell it that there's a placeholder that needs to be filled in later.
Yeah, so we need to write down a list of placeholders, is the idea. And that's exactly a data structure that's going to be appear in an object file. And these are called relocations, because we're relocating the placeholder to go to the actual correct location. So the relocations are generally of a pretty simple form. They don't involve understanding the machine code at all. They just say, hey linker, 6 bytes into the machine code, there's something you need to replace with wherever the data segment ends up, whatever memory address that's going to have when this is loaded into memory. And similarly, 10 bytes into there, there's something you need to replace with the address of putS. That's the call, but all the linker sees is that 10 bytes into this machine code, please place the address that you find putS at. So we have the name putS. Okay. So there's one additional piece of information that we better have in this object file. So can anyone think of what from this assembly am I not representing in this object file that we're going to need to know when we link to actually make an executable that works? Yeah.
Does it need to know like the other .conf files that it's referred to so they can jump back?
Okay, so your proposal is that you need to know the other .o files, right? And yeah, so with the linking steps I gave you, it might kind of look like that because we're not specifying them here. But what happens in practice is not that. We don't actually store it in the .o files. Instead, we tell you, sorry, you have to put it on the command line if it's not default. So the reason you've never come across this probably is that by default, your compiler, when you link, automatically includes the standard library.o files. But if you had some other library, you actually need to specify it. It's not going to figure it out for you. It's not going to have, so there's not support for having that information, even though that's a very sensible thing to do. Like, that's how Java works, right? You import something and that goes in the class file. Not what happens here. Okay, so any other ideas for what might be missing? Yeah.
When this stop.
When this stop?
Yeah, when the return.
The return?
Yeah.
So the return instruction, this instruction here, is that what you mean? So that is in this machine code, not that you'd ever know that, because I don't expect you to know x86 machine code, but the return instruction's in the machine code. We do need some way of actually writing this down so it's unambiguous where the machine code starts and ends, which I kind of glossed over. So there's some sort of very big piece of information, which I guess no one sees, and that is this. So we have this label in the assembly, and when we link this together, we want the linker to know, hey, that's where you start the program. So we need to write down that that's where the main function is. And so that goes in something called a symbol table. So we write down in the object file, hey, something called main was defined in this file, and it's at this part of the file, and the linker can figure out when it actually figures it out the memory layout where that ends up being in, as a memory address, so it can tell things how to start up the program correctly. Or if this was putS instead of main, so you can tell how to find putS given the file. So any questions on anything in this object file here? Yes? What?
What else would belong in the symbol table?
So the question is, what else is in the symbol table? So the symbol table, in general, will contain every label defined in the .s file that you might need to access from another file.
Okay.
So in particular, you better have a label for every function, so you can call the function from another .o file. Yes?
So a symbol table is like a table of contents for the...
So the question is, a symbol table is like a table of contents? Yes, that's a pretty good analogy. You can also think of it as more as an index. Yeah. But that sort of idea. Okay. So given this .o file, as we mentioned, what we're going to do next is we're going to combine it with some other .o files. For example, whatever .o file contains puts, I've called it on this slide, standby.o, but that might not be its real name, and produce the actual hello executable. And as I mentioned earlier, what that executable is going to contain is just something to copy from the file on disk into memory at a well-known location. So the linker is going to take these .o files. It's going to say, I'm going to place the text part, the code part of hello.o here, followed by the code part of standard.io.o here, followed by the data part of hello.o here, followed by the data part of standard.io. So it's going to figure out where it's putting things in memory, then fill in all the addresses based on that, and then write out that information into the executable. So when we load the program, we just copy that with all the addresses filled in into memory and just run it. So our executable just has the bytes with all the addresses filled in, and there's no more work to do to run the executable than just stupidly copying it into memory and then jumping to wherever the start address is. So any questions about any part of this process? Yes?
Could you go over quickly why it's broken down into so many steps?
So the question is, why is this broken down into so many steps? So why do we go, so what steps would you like to skip, first of all? What steps would you like to skip? So you asked why it's broken down into so many steps. So I'm guessing that you think that some of these steps seem like you shouldn't do. Like, what steps do you think seem wasteful?
Well, I guess they're all translations of the same information.
Okay, so your comment is this all has the same information. Yeah, okay. So maybe we could be easier. Yeah, So for the last part, there's a really good justification, which is that by producing object files this way, I can compile hello.o once, and I can change the standard.io.o without recompiling everything. So I'm saving myself from doing more work whenever I want to change other part code in my application, like the implementation of puts. So that's the main advantage of object files versus going directly from assembly, a bunch of assembly files, to an executable, which we could imagine a program that does that. So the main advantage is that we compile the object file separately. If we change one object file, we don't need to recompile all the others. We're saving a lot of work. Yeah?
So are all the files processed by the same part of the computer?
So the question is, are all the files processed by the same part of the computer? So, internally, generally, there's actually a different program to do each of these steps. So you don't notice that because you use this program called GCC, which actually internally calls other programs. But usually it's separate programs for each step, which only just do that sort of functionality. So, and as for the other step that you might skip, you could imagine going from hello.c directly to hello.o. That's not ridiculous. But I think it probably makes it a lot easier to write a compiler if you produce kind of human readable outputs. Yeah?
I don't know if I missed it at all, but on the executable, when it says code from stdio.o and the data from it, so the code at the top is from hello.o?
Yeah.
And then, so they just, I just don't get like why they didn't list parts of hello.o and the parts of stdio.o.
Sorry, so the question is, why don't I have parentheses code from hello.o? Is that the question?
Yeah.
So the reason I don't have that is that this data here is literally a copy of this.
Okay. And so it's just a format like
Yeah, so it's the code from hello.o is that those hexadecimal numbers represent it.
Okay, so why did you say for stdio.o?
Because I never showed you what's in that standard io.o, so you couldn't figure out that it's from standard io.o if I didn't tell you.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
How are methods represented in assembly?
So the question is, how is the put s calls or the declaration?
Like, how does it work? How do you have a print method in assembly?
A print method? So something like put s on the slide. So that's going to be, it's going to have assembly that looks kind of similar to our assembly for main, except the name is put s. And then we'll make an auto file out of that. And because the symbol table says put s at some location, the linker will figure it out. If we're not talking about methods of classes, we're just talking about methods outside any class, which I will call functions, but I know that's not what people use. Yeah. So the question is, the linker puts all the code together and all the data together, even though they're from different files. Yes, that's typically how things work. Much later in the semester, we can explain why you want to do that, why that's a good idea. But for now, it kind of seems like you could do it either way. Okay, any other questions about this? Okay, so given no more questions, here's a question for you. So here's a simple C file. So when we compile, assemble and link this into an executable, what files are going to contain the memory address of the function say hello? So I want you to figure this out and check with your neighbor that you have similar answers.
Thank you.
Okay, so people seem to have settled down. So who thinks the answer is A, B, C, D, E, and F? Okay. So does anyone want to defend their answer? Okay.
I think B and C, because it has the physical, like the hexadecimal, so I thought that's what they might be just as hard. So if it's in the B dial, it's also in B and C.
Okay. So you have this idea that we've translated, gone from this text format in assembler to binary. So probably that contains the memory address. So that's a good thought. And we certainly have space for the memory address. And it seems to be common confusion. But if you remember earlier, we do kind of have some representation of that. Like we have a symbol table which says where it is in the file. And we have a place for it in the assembly, in the call instruction. But we don't actually have the address filled in there. We still have a placeholder. So we have a placeholder for it, but it's not yet the real address. We have a place where it should be, but it's not there yet because the linker hasn't done its job. Yes?
So just a clarifying question. What is a linker? It's like a makefile and linker.
So the question is, what is a linker? The linker is part of something like GCC.
Oh.
So it's the thing. So the question was, what is a linker? It's the thing that gets run when you run this command.
Okay.
It's the part of GCC that runs. So, yeah. So, and that question was very tricky because I said memory address. And if I just said address, that wouldn't be clear because we tell where the file things are, which is a location at least, but not the memory address. So it's a very subtle distinction. That's why I asked the question. So the right answer is actually C. So it's only in the executable because we have to put it there after we have the object file. The object file almost contains it because it says where it is in the file. Like if there's an explicit thing in the symbol table saying, hey, you can find say hello at this part of the file, but that's not yet a memory address. Even though it's sort of an address in the file, but it's not a memory address. Yes?
So this executable sort of condenses assembly in an object file, so
then the
object file
needs
to be processed.
So the question is, does the executable condense all the object file? Yes, so they don't need to process? So you could think of, we could imagine that instead of producing an executable, that every time we need to run a program, we just load a bunch of object files, figure all this stuff out, figure out how to fill in those placeholders and put them in memory. And in fact, real computers do something called dynamic linking for many programs, in addition to the linking I'm talking about, where they do some of that at runtime. So usually there's some linking happening when you build an executable and some later on, which we won't talk about how dynamic linking works. It's actually a little different. But conceptually, there's no reason you can't do it at runtime, and people really do because it's kind of nice to have your programs use the latest version of a library and not have your programs contain copies of all the library code and things like that. Yes?
For us, in the first example, it made sense why you had to wait until the executable, until the linker occurred for put S because it was in a different library.
Yeah.
But how can you have to wait until the linker happens when say hello is literally defined the exact same file?
So the question is, why can't the assembler not generate a placeholder, right? And the reason is because even though we know where things are relatively, we haven't actually decided what order we're going to write things out in the executable. That's the linker to decide. The linker, you know, also even gets to decide where we start putting the executable. Like I showed you that it starts at an address by convention, but the linker can choose something else on most platforms. So we just haven't made the decision on where everything is in memory, even though we know relatively where these two things likely will be. We haven't actually made the final decision. So the assembler, even though it knows where it's defined in the file, can't actually know where that is in memory yet. Yeah.
So in this example, why is the
why is the put s, so the question is why is put the put, why did I not write put s in the .c file?
Yeah, because I was just thinking that you would see put s in the .c file, and you'd also see put s in the assembly file, but you don't see either.
Okay, so the reason why we don't have, so the implementation of put s is in another file. And you might think that, oh, you have to do that pound include thing to be able to use put s, so maybe it's in that .h file, and the .h file should end up in the .s file. And that's a reasonable thought, but that's usually not how things work. Usually, the .h file is only going to contain a declaration of put s, and we're going to rely on having some other file in some location that's not well advertised on your computer actually containing the code for put s. And this is makes compiling faster, for example, because we don't put a copy of putS in every single thing you have that uses standard io.h, even if you don't use putS. But it is a good question. But it is reasonable to think, hey, why doesn't standard io.h just contain a declaration that ends up in the .s file, a definition rather, and that's just to save space. You could have put a definition in there. Okay. Any other questions about this? Yeah.
When you have the executable file on your hard drive, that means that put s is confined to a certain space in your memory while that executable exists.
Yeah, so yes. So a copy of put s, the code, is loaded to a certain place in memory. So are you complaining because you're worried about running multiple programs?
Well,
and
you plug in like a USB.
Okay, so the question is, you know, since the executables have a particular place for everything, how do I load executables, you know, put my executables on my disk? So one clarification is that the stuff being put in memory only happens when you run an executable. It happens separately each time you run it. Even though that seems kind of slow to copy it from disk every time, that's our model of what happens for now. So when you copy it from a USB key to your hard drive, nothing happens because you aren't running it. When you actually run it from anywhere, it gets copied into memory at that particular location. Does that answer your question? Okay. So as a follow-up to this, so which of these files contain the literal string in ASCII as a sequence of bytes with ASCII values? Hello world. Same thing, figure out the answer and check with your neighbors if they think they have the same answer. Answers to this? Any questions? Clarifications? Yeah.
Yeah, when you said literal ASCII string,
the string literal, like the ASCII number for capital H followed by the ASCII number for lowercase e, and so on. Okay, any other clarifications or other questions? Okay. So like the bytes, that represent it. Like it literally in the file, if I read byte by byte, it's those ASCII values. Okay, so I hope that's clear enough. I know that this gets kind of fuzzy. So with that, who thinks the answer is A? B? C, D, E, okay, and F, okay, who has no clue? Okay, so anyone want to defend their answer? And we'll say this question is less, has a more ambiguous answer than the other. Yeah.
Well, if you're displaying the text in the .c file, it's somewhere in the
.s file.
It's going to be represented in ASCII, right?
Yeah. So, this is the reasoning for E.
Yeah.
So the reason, so one reasoning for E is that if we have the text in the C file, we're going to put it in the .s file. The easiest way to put it is just by copying the literal bytes, which are ASCII, an ASCII byte for capital H and so on, because that's what text files are, into the .s file, as is, as text. And the easiest thing to do in the .o file is to copy the literal bytes that represent the string in there, because we want those in memory anyways, in that exact way, and so on. And so they'll end up in the .o file and the executable. So that's that's a reasoning for E, which I think is the best answer. Now, I didn't give you enough information to guarantee that the compiler actually puts it in the .s file and doesn't do something as a string and doesn't do something funny, like write it out as a sequence of numbers and text. So there is an argument that maybe that doesn't happen. But most commonly compilers will do this, but maybe not always. I've seen them do something weird where they write it out as some other format. But by the time it's in the .o file, we have this string in memory in our executable, and it's going to be as those bytes in the part of the .o file, the linker is going to copy into the executable, and we want it in memory eventually when the program runs as those bytes, because that's what putS is going to look for in memory. It expects the ASCII bytes that that are literally a capital H, lowercase e, and so on in memory as bytes. So any questions about this? Yes?
Wouldn't those characters be distinct from binary, and isn't the executable in binary?
So the question isn't the executable in binary? So it is true that the executable is not a text file. So all files on our computers, not on every operating system, but in every operating system you used, are sequences of bytes. So if it's a text file, it's a sequence of bytes, and it's just that we interpret those bytes as ASCII characters or some other type of characters. If it's an executable file, we interpret those bytes as things to copy into memory. But the same bytes are going to be used for the string, regardless of whether it's a text file or a string that ends up in our executable. So, for example, if you produce this executable and open it up in a text editor, you get a whole bunch of like unprintable junk, but you probably, not guaranteed, would actually see the string hello world in your text editor next to weird junk that doesn't make any sense. Because it actually is in there in the same way it would be represented in a text file. Does that make sense? Okay. But that is a very common confusion. That's why I asked this question. Because I asked it at a post quiz last semester, and almost no one got it. Okay, so let's move on from this to talking about C. So now that we talked about how we translate C all the way down to machine code, let's start at the top at C, and talk about C for a bit, then we'll talk about assembly for a bit, and then we'll talk about machine code for a bit. So C has data types. Data types in C and C++ vary between machines. This is not defined by the language. It depends what machine you're using and what compiler you're using sometimes. For this course, we will be using systems where these are the sizes. A char is a 1-byte integer. Yes, it's an integer. A short is a 2-byte integer. An int is a 4-byte integer. A long is an 8-byte integer. Floats are 4 bytes. Doubles are 8 bytes, but not integers, obviously. They're floating point numbers. And pointers are always 8 bytes, no matter the kind of pointer. So you may notice that there's one data type that you really like that's missing here, and that's bool. So if you use C++, you maybe came across the bool type to represent a true or false value. If you used Java, you know Boolean. Nothing like this exists in C as far as we'll discuss in this class. So you might say, well, doesn't C have Boolean operators? And yeah, it does. So, for example, x equals equals 4, it has to produce a value of some type. Since there's no bool type, it can't be a bool. The type that the people who made C chose is int. So it will produce a 1 if that equality is true, and a 0 otherwise. That's how all the logical operators work in C. Yes?
So is it actually an int, or is it like a byte, or like a
So the question is it actually an int, or is it some of smaller type like a char?
Yeah.
So the answer is that it is actually an int, which does seem wasteful. This is a decision the C designers made. There's reasoning for it, but there's a lot of history involved too, which maybe you wouldn't do this today, but that's how it is. So since we don't have a true or false type, you might ask, so what values are true and false? So I've indicated to you that 0 probably is interpreted as false, and 1 is probably interpreted as true. So let's start with the list of false values. This is the exhaustive, complete list of false values in C. That's 0, including null pointers, which are the result of converting 0 to a pointer. All other values in C are true. Doesn't matter what they are. So this means that the logical operators will interpret anything else, anything that's not zero, as true. So negative 1, it's true. Empty strings, true. So that, because that's the definition of falseness in C. Any questions about this? So the logical operators return 0 or 1, but they treat anything that's not zero as true. Even if you might think that maybe negative 1 shouldn't be true, sorry it is. Empty strings shouldn't be true, sorry they are. Okay. Any questions? Okay. So since we're talking about logical operators like this, I have a note about something about the logical operators in C and C++ and also Java that you probably didn't come across. So here, I have this program which uses the logical OR operator. And I have a function 0 which prints out 0 and returns 0, and a function 1 which prints out 1 and returns 1. And I print out the result of 0 or 1 and 1 or 0, and this is the output I get. This is the actual output I get. So in the first case, things seem normal. I get 0 followed by 1. Because we call 0, it returns 0. We call 1, it returns 1. We OR them together, we get 1, because that represents true in C, and that's what we print out. In the second case, we call 1, you get 1, and then 0 isn't called. So why wouldn't this happen? Yeah?
It stops once you get to the first truth with all you need for
it. Yeah, so what we're doing, and you can reason about this with the truth table, is that in this case, when we get 0, we know it's false or with something, and we don't know whether it's true or false yet, so we need to call 1. And in the second case, when we get 1, we know that the result's going to be true, so we don't need to do any more work to compute it. So the C compiler saves some work in this case and doesn't even bother calling 0. And this also happens in C++ and Java. This is not just an optimization. This is not optional. The C language requires this to happen in all cases. The compiler doesn't have a choice not to do this. It must do this. Okay. Any questions about this? So this is part of the definition of how the OR, logical OR operator works in C. And the same thing is true of AND. So if we AND 0 with 1, we look at our 0, we say, oh, the result has to be false. I don't need to bother checking the next part of this with the 1. So I'm just not going to do that. Any questions about this? So this will hopefully keep you from being surprised when things don't run when you might expect them to. So that note on short-circuiting operators, this is called short-circuiting. You'll see that name written down for this style of operators, which exist in many languages. I'm just mentioning it because in the past we've noticed that people apparently haven't seen it in 2110 or 2150, even though they've been using it the whole time in Java and C++. So the second note is about strings in C. Yeah, sorry.
In the previous slide, what do the symbols for the 1 and 0?
So the question is, what are these strings that I'm passing to printf? They indicate to print out an integer. We will talk about this more on Tuesday. C does not have C out. So we have to use something else. And that's the something else. So first, I'm going to talk about strings before we get there. So C does not have a string type. There's no string class or anything like that. So to represent a string, we have a pointer to its first character. So if you have this string hello world, then we're going to have hello is going to be a pointer to the capital H at the beginning of that, which is going to be followed in memory by the E, then the L, then the L, then the O, and so on. This is how we represent strings. And we know where the end of the string is by placing what I represent there as a quote backslash zero, which is the character with the literal value zero, the number zero, byte zero in memory. That's how we know where the end of the string is. This is the convention. All the functions which deal with strings in C will look for that. Any questions about this string representation? Yeah.
So is the string an array of
characters? So the string is the array of characters. So the question is the string array of characters or just characters? Yeah, the string is the array of characters. We'll usually refer to strings by having a pointer to them, like this. And I might not be consistent, and our textbook might not be consistent about distinguishing between pointers to strings and the actual storage. I'm sorry. Yes. So the question is, why does this backslash zero thing looks like two characters? Why are you putting it in one box?
Yeah.
So backslash zero, so like backslash n represents a new line. You know about that? So backslash zero is something like that. So it's one character, it's a representation of one character, and that character is the ASCII character with the value zero. So the question is, if you concatenate backslash zero to an existing string, like add a backslash zero to the end of this, so it depends whether it's actually that character zero or a backslash followed by a zero, right? So if it's actually that character zero, it will do nothing because as far as C is concerned, the string ends where the first ASCII zero is. If you concatenate if you replace the zero with a backslash and then a zero and then another, and then the ASCII zero, and you'll add backslash zero, can you print it out at the end of the string? Other questions? Yes?
Is the const part necessary?
So the question, I wrote const char star, is that necessary? The answer is no. And this is even though the string, the literal hello world, will point you to read-only memory. But C allows you to have something that's not Marcus const that points to something read-only, in the case of strings, because of bad history. Don't recommend you do it. If you don't know about const, you can probably ignore it for this class. But if you do, the sorry story is that C doesn't enforce it as much as C++. Other questions about this? Okay. So, since I said strings are pointers, you might ask, how do I get at other parts of the string? So, C lets you do pointer arithmetic. So you can take a pointer and basically treat it kind of like a number. So if I have a pointer to the beginning of the string, if I add 0 to that, it still points to the same place, but I can like add 5 and advance 5 characters in the string. So the hello pointer points to the capital H, hello plus 5 will point to that space after hello. And then I can take these pointers and dereference them and actually get the individual character. And this addition is basically just doing an addition on the actual internal address that's stored in the pointer. So it's very straightforward to do in assembly. And you know, this is, you know, gets you all you need to do to access the string, but maybe it's a little inconvenient to type out things like this. So C has an alternate syntax for this, which is something you're familiar with. It's the sort of array element accessing syntax. And that's the same thing. So I can take hello, the thing that points to H, take index 0 of it, and that gives me the thing it points to. If I take index 5, that gives me the thing five characters after what it points to. Any questions about this? Yeah.
Will it throw an error if you go too far?
So the question is, will it throw an error if you go too far? So on Tuesday, probably, maybe Thursday, we will talk about something called undefined behavior. Which is what happens there. The short answer is maybe. So don't do it. Okay. So you're probably familiar with this syntax from accessing arrays, and you might say, well, how do arrays work then? Arrays aren't pointers. And you're correct that arrays aren't pointers. But in C++, these are always exactly the same. And the way that works with arrays is that if you have an array, when you try to use it in a way that a pointer is expected, which includes this sort of index syntax, it gets implicitly turned into a pointer to the first element of the array. So this is how array accesses work in C. Is that saying array of 5, index 5, gets a pointer to the first thing from the array, adds 5 to it, and dereferences that. And there's just a convenient way of writing it, but you can write it both of these ways. It's always exactly the same. And we call, you might see C references call the thing where you take an array and use it as a pointer, as it decaying into a pointer, because it loses some information in that process and turns into a pointer to the first element. So doesn't know it's part of an array anymore. Once you do that conversion. Yes?
If you wanted to add a word to a string, would you have to make a new array?
So the question is, if I want to add something to a string, would I have to make a new array?
Yeah.
So you would need space to add something. And what I've shown so far doesn't show you any way of getting more space, but something like malloc or new could do that. Well, there's no new, but there's malloc, which is almost the same as new. Yes?
What you have above, is that assuming that
So the question is, this assume that each array element is 1 byte. So it would seem, with the examples I've shown so far, it seems that way. It turns out, and we'll probably get to this next time, that C does the right thing, so this works, for array elements that aren't 1 byte, which means they don't just add to the address, they multiply by the size and add. But right now the size is 1, so it's simple, and that's why I started with this. And so, as a last piece of review, since you know this rule about foo of 0 and star foo plus 0 being the same, here's some code. figure out what you think the final value of foo is. I note that this foo up here, I've declared it as an array and not a pointer. And I did that so I can write to it. Because if I just declared it as a pointer, I'd have a pointer to the string constant somewhere, and it's not guaranteed to be able to change that because it's a constant. But this is an array that's going to be stored on the stack. So do this, figure out what you think the answer is, check if your neighbor agrees. I would do this by writing things down because I don't like keeping track of three things in my head, but you don't have to. See, no one is. Give you a little extra time. I will. So who thinks it's A, B, C? Okay, so everyone figured it out. Almost, at least. Close enough. So basic explanation is we have this on the stack. Pointer initially points to that F at the beginning. This statement sets the F to a B. Then we make pointer point to the second O. We do pointer of 0 equals C. I would recommend you use the other style for this, but you don't have to, but that's better style to treat pointers in the non-array index way. And then we have that weird syntax where we could have used the array index syntax to access. And remember, post-quiz starting this between this evening and Saturday.